From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the state wants to set standards for the way each county serves poor and low-income defendants.
Unfortunately, at this point, Michigan's system for providing indigent defense is woefully insufficient.
But Oakland County is suing the state over these standards.
We're not opposed to making changes to the system as long as it's done lawfully.
Plus, being Muslim and black in Michigan.
Islam is as American as baseball, as apple pie.
The app that helps anyone who needs to pawn something. You get to see what the pawn shops will offer, and you choose the best offer.
But you know, when you're low income, when you're shot for cash, you don't have time to go from shop to shop like we did, and you don't feel empowered to negotiate.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tomorrow morning, the State Court of Claims will hear a lawsuit filed by Oakland County. The county is challenging new criminal defense standards for defendants who are poor or indigent. These new standards were set by a panel appointed by Governor Snyder. The idea? To get uniform standards throughout the state. Each county is supposed to draw up a compliance plan and submit it to the state by mid-November. Thus, Oakland County is suing the state. Tom Boyd is here with us now. He is a judge in Ingham County's 55th District Court, and he's a member of the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission. It's the panel that set these new standards. Judge Boyd, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Before we get to the specifics of Oakland County's position, remind us why the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission even exists. Why is this necessary?
The short version is in 2008, the National League and Legal Aid and Defender Association did a study at the request of the Michigan legislature of the statewide system for providing lawyers to poor people accused of crime. That report is titled Race to the Bottom. Essentially, it concluded that we're much more worried about dollars than justice, and that in a variety of ways we don't deliver the constitutionally mandated effective assistance to counsel to indigent persons who are accused of crimes.
Which is provided by the Constitution, so this is not in debate.
The United States Constitution has indicated this for a long time. In 1963, the United States Supreme Court, in the case Gideon versus Wainwright, made it clear that the right to an attorney also meant that if you were poor, the right to have an attorney paid for by the government. So it's been 54 years since Gideon was decided, and Michigan and other states are still really grappling with how to effectively do this. And unfortunately, at this point, Michigan's system for providing indigent defense is woefully insufficient.
So to begin the reform process, the commission has come up with this set of four new standards for counties to implement. What are these standards?
The four standards have to do with continuing legal education for lawyers, access to experts and independent investigators, appearing with the defendant at the very first time they are before the court, and how quickly you meet with and have a substantive conversation with the client, the defendant. Those are the four standards.
Is it that our courts in Michigan have not been doing these things, or some have been doing them and some haven't?
Yeah, it's really, there's 83 counties and 250 district court judges in counties and cities and townships, and there's just across the board people doing a nice job and people doing woefully inadequate. In 2013, the United States Supreme Court decided a case named Lafler versus Cooper, which comes out of the Wayne County Circuit Court. The defendant had shot at someone, and the prosecuting attorney made a very reasonable plea offer, and the defense lawyer, appointed by the government, suggested or counseled his client not to accept the plea deal because everyone knows that if you shoot someone under the waist, below the waist, you can't be convicted of attempted murder.
Oh.
Well, this is preposterous advice. It has no basis in fact or law. The Court of Appeals in Michigan didn't change it. The Michigan Supreme Court did not change it. So in a written opinion in 2013, the United States Supreme Court said, seriously, Michigan, what are you doing? And reverse that conviction. So we're in a situation where in rural counties all across the state, people aren't afforded a lawyer before they have a pretrial, meaning a meeting with the prosecutor. In 2013, in a case named Missouri versus Fry, the United States Supreme Court said, yes, you have to have a lawyer at pretrial. We haven't made those changes.
Well, in July, Oakland County filed a lawsuit against the state and against your panel, your commission, as well as the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs to stay compliant, saying, hey, these requirements violate the state constitution. Do they?
No. I guess that there's just no is the answer to that question. The challenges from Oakland County are not new. Way back in the fall of 2012, when the legislation was making its way through the Michigan legislature that created the Michigan Indigenous Defense Commission, Oakland County submitted memos mimicking the same arguments they're making in this lawsuit today.
Which, in kind of a nutshell, they're saying it's violating the separation of powers doctrine set out by the Michigan Constitution and infringes on the Michigan Supreme Court's exclusive authority to set rules governing the practice and procedure. And you're saying that's not the case.
Yeah, I would first say you've stated their argument pretty well, pretty succinctly. They're suggesting that the Indigenous Defense Commission is trying to interfere with the practice of law, and that's in the sole province of the Michigan Supreme Court. And there's really just two very simple things to say to help people understand how wrong that is.
Go ahead. Tell us.
First, in June 1st of 2016, the Michigan Supreme Court issued an administrative order conditionally approving each of these four standards. Second, you have to look at the prosecuting attorney. The prosecuting attorney is independently elected official, and he or she maintains a supervision of an office of assistant prosecuting attorneys in every county in the state. That prosecuting attorney is regulating the work of their subordinates, and they're representing the state, pursuing prosecution in cases. The Indigenous Defense Commission Act is attempting to set up the same thing on the other side, managed not by the court, but by either the legislative or the executive branch of local government. Just like the prosecuting attorney. If you can imagine today, if you just take any sports analogy you want, two teams take the field of battle and then there's some man or woman in black and white stripes in the middle who's the official. In our system of justice, it should be the same way. There should be a prosecutor and a defense. The judge, he or she, should be the person in the middle wearing black and white, calling balls and strikes, calling touchdowns, whatever. And the way it is today, the defense function is controlled by the judiciary. So it's as if the umpire or the referee controls one of the teams on the field. Yeah. So that's really the basic corrupt nature of the system that's been allowed to evolve since 1963 in Michigan.
Judge, I want to read you a quote from Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson, quoted by the Oakland Press in July when the lawsuit announced. And here's his quote. This will not improve our criminal justice system. The state said, don't worry, we will give you the money. We will have to reconfigure the courthouses and have court-appointed counsel at the arraignments. People who wrote those rules, which probably came out of the state legislature, probably never worked in a courthouse. This is not how it works. How would you care to respond to that, Judge?
Well, first, I wrote a lot of those rules. You know, working as a member of the Governor Snyder's Advisory Commission on Indigent Defense. So he's wrong there. Second, under the guidance and with a grant from the State Court Administrator's Office, my court and the 63rd Court for Kent County did pilot projects to determine if we can efficiently and effectively provide lawyers at first appearance, lawyers at arraignment. Both pilot projects were incredibly successful. Ours was so successful that Ingham County has, after the grant funding ran out, continued to fund that. And today, at the 55th District Court for Ingham County, everybody who comes in for arraignment, whether in custody or walking the front door, will have a lawyer.
What this seems to be is about money and about trust. I mean, Oakland County officials say that these changes could cost up to $18 million annually. And according to the Detroit News, the county budget's about $3 million annually now for indigent defense. And they don't trust that the state's going to give them that money to supplement these changes that the MIDC is requiring. And I'm guessing they're not alone here. If you consider the state legislature's history of slashing city and county revenue sharing, it does seem fairly reasonable. Counties are feeling a little uneasy, no?
No, I think you've got it exactly right. I'm in a county-funded court. It is one of the many reasons that the Michigan Association of Counties insisted and received in the Indigenous Defense Commission Act guarantees on that point exactly. What the Act says is every funding unit will submit this compliance plan with a budget. The budgets will be either approved or rejected or questioned by the Indigenous Defense Commission, then aggregated and sent to the legislature. The legislature will either appropriate the money or they won't. If they appropriate the money, the county then has 60 days, I think it's, no, I'm sorry, I think it's 180 days to implement those changes. If the money is not appropriated, there is zero burden on the county. Other than, I might add, the existing United States Constitution, which they're currently violating. But no new burden. The burden that they already have, that they're already ignoring in many counties, doesn't change.
Have you had conversations with lawmakers to get a sense that they will appropriate the necessary funds to make not only these four recommendations happen, but future ones as well?
The question is twofold. First, should I trust the legislature? No, that would be madness. Second, should I trust this law? Clearly, it says you don't have to do anything until the check clears. And if the next year's appropriation doesn't come, you can stop. I mean, the law is really clearly written. Oakland County and the Michigan Association of Counties won these fights in the legislature. And for some reason, they don't see what they won. There is a paradigm shift in seeing that the defense function is not a function of the judiciary. It is not a function of the independent arbiter who's going to make independent decisions. It has to be an independent function, just like the prosecution is independent, or we can't have a true adversarial process, which is what we're supposed to have in Michigan.
Judge, how would you characterize Oakland County's lawsuit?
75% of their lawsuit is rehashing issues that have already been pretty thoroughly handled by the Michigan Supreme Court and by amendments of the legislature. And the final quarter is so narrowly drawn as to really call into question what their motives are. I will say, to be fair, the Oakland County government has proceeded with developing a compliance plan. And all of my colleagues, district court judges from Oakland County, tell me that they believe that the county government is acting in good faith in proceeding with their compliance plans. So I want to make it, I don't want to make it sound like they're just dragging their feet, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that stall might be one of their major motivations. I don't really know to what end.
Judge, should, let's hypothetically say, should the legislature not approve the money, you can't cut the checks to the counties, do we open ourselves up to constitutional challenges?
Absolutely. The United States Constitution is clear. You have a right to have a lawyer, and since 1963, you have a right to have a lawyer paid for by the government if you can't afford one. In lots of places in Michigan, we're not doing that.
Judge Tom Boyd is a member of the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission and a judge in Ingham County's 55th District Court. Judge, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Coming up, a new app that levels the playing field between a seller and a pawn shop.
We had a diamond ring that, you know, got $65 at one shop and $1,000 at another.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier in the hour, we talked about new standards for defending low-income and indigent people who've been charged with a crime. A state panel set the standards to ensure every county in Michigan provides the same level of service to these defendants. Oakland County is suing the state over these standards. The suit will be heard tomorrow morning in the Michigan Court of Claims. Here with us now is Oakland County's Corporation Counsel, Keith Lermino. Keith, welcome. Why is Oakland County against implementing these four basic standards the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission has come up with?
Well, at the outset, I want to make it clear that Oakland County supports indigent defendants having competent counsel, and that's not really what this is about. We do have a system in place now that's working reasonably well, at least in terms of our courts here in Oakland County that we fund. But I guess our perspective is if, and we're not opposed to making improvements in the system at all, but our perspective is if you're going to make changes to the system that exists, that you need to do it in a lawful and constitutional manner. And in our view, what has been proposed here and what they're trying to implement is, first of all, unconstitutional, and secondly, it's our view that the MIDC folks are failing to comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. Specifically, they're engaging in conduct that violates the separation of powers doctrine. They're trying to directly regulate attorneys, which is exclusively reserved to the Michigan Supreme Court. They are also trying to regulate court matters. And keep in mind, the MIDC is under LARA, which is an executive branch of the state government. So we think that the steps they're trying to take are unconstitutional. that they are failing to comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. And really, by their own admission, the statutory scheme and some of the standards also conflict with existing statutes and court rules. So this is, you know, causing quite a concern for us. You know, we want to get some clarification as to whether we should be doing these things or not. That's why we filed a lawsuit, and that's why we're going to be asking the court to stay this until the court makes a decision on the merits.
Well, the state Supreme Court issued a conditional order approving each of those standards back in June 2016, and there was one concern, which was fixed by the legislature with a bill that was signed into law this past January. So it would seem that the state Supreme Court is satisfied with this. So what is the concern Oakland County has?
Well, I don't think it's accurate to say that the Michigan Supreme Court is satisfied with this. One of the Supreme Court officials issued a communication to the chief judges of all the circuit courts early this year saying, you know, the court conditionally approved these standards, provided that these problems were fixed by the end of the year. They were not fixed by the end of the year, and this shouldn't be read to mean that we're approving of the standards. In fact, in our view, I mean, it's going to have to be determined by the court ultimately, but originally MIDC was going to be under the Supreme Court. With the amendments that were adopted in January, MIDC was taken out from under the Supreme Court, and they had constitutional concerns when it was under their jurisdiction. The MIDC amendments took the MIDC out of from under the Michigan Supreme Court and moved it to an executive branch of state government. Again, I think the court's going to have to determine this, but I think they exacerbated the concerns that were expressed by the Michigan Supreme Court. I don't think they resolved them, but that's my view, and I admit to a little bit of bias.
County Executive Al Brooks Patterson, in an interview with the Oakland Press, this was his quote about these standards. Here's his quote. "You can't take the state's promises to the bank. This will cost the taxpayers millions, and they get nothing from it." The question is this larger issue about the money it would take to implement the changes? We've seen quotes of about Oakland County estimating it'll cost up to about $18 million to comply with these standards. How'd the county come up with that number?
Well, it's an estimate based on some educated guesses. The lawsuit, if we're just talking about the lawsuit that we filed in the Court of Claims, although the lawsuit makes some reference to the fact that the legislature has not appropriated any money for this yet, and that remains to be true today, the lawsuit really is more about the constitutionality of these measures and whether MIDC is complying with the Administrative Procedures Act. We're not asking for monetary relief in the lawsuit that we have filed. There may be litigation in the future as to whether or not this is a Headley violation. This is a function that the state is mandating that the local units undertake. They indicate that they're going to pay for it, but to date, there's been no funding forthcoming from the legislature. So we are concerned about the funding that's not directly involved in the lawsuit that we have filed in the Court of Claims at this juncture.
Sure. So stepping apart from the lawsuit and talking about that money, because that comment from Mr. Patterson pretty well focuses on the money, and that idea that the state legislature appropriate the money before the county does anything seems to be a misunderstanding of the process. Let me play this clip. We spoke with Judge Tom Boyd, who's a member of the Indigent Defense Commission, and here's how he said the process will be handled.
What the Act says is every funding unit will submit this compliance plan with a budget. The budgets will be either approved or rejected or questioned by the Indigent Defense Commission, then aggregated and sent to the legislature. The legislature will either appropriate the money or they won't. If they appropriate the money, the county then has, I think it's 180 days to implement those changes. If the money is not appropriated, there is zero burden on the county. Other than, I might add, the existing United States Constitution, which they're currently violating.
So if the law says the county it doesn't have to do a thing, if the legislature doesn't appropriate the money, then where is the problem?
Well, my response to that is we are currently working on our compliance plan right now. And we're expending substantial amounts of county resources just to put the compliance plan together. Their responsibility to pay us comes when the compliance plan is approved, and if it's not approved or they don't pay us, then we don't have to implement it. But the fact of the matter remains, this is an ongoing effort, and we're incurring expenses right now because we're under a deadline to submit a compliance plan by November 20th.
But all right, let's look at that, touch on that question of constitutionality that Judge Boyd referred to. And I'm going to go back to the statement to the Oakland Press by Mr. Patterson. He said, and here's his quote, "We will have to reconfigure the courthouses and have court-appointed counsel at the arraignments. People who wrote these rules, which probably came out of the state legislature, probably never worked in a courthouse. This is not how it works." That's the end of his quote. That remark would seem to imply, would it not, that court-appointed counsel is not always at arraignments?
They're not, and they're not constitutionally required to be at arraignments under existing law.
Well, okay, let me ask you about the 2013 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Missouri versus Frye, and here is what the court said. The Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel extends to consideration of plea offers that lapse or are rejected, and that right applies to all critical stages of the criminal proceedings.
An arraignment is not a critical stage of the proceeding. There's a lot of case law, that's including U.S. Supreme Court cases, that say that the arraignment is not a critical court proceeding. It may be that indigent defendants are entitled to the appointment of defense counsel after the arraignment, but the arraignment is not considered to be a critical stage per U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
So this question of having an attorney at that very first court appearance, that it seems to matter looking at, for example, a study by the Arnold Foundation that focuses on criminal justice research and reform. And it used data in its study from state courts and found defendants who were detained for the entire pretrial period were over four times more likely to be sentenced to jail and over three times more likely to be sentenced to prison than defendants who were released at some point pending trial. And the sentences were significantly longer, too, almost three times as long for defendants sentenced to jail and more than twice as long for those sentenced to prison. So having an attorney at that first court appearance would seem to matter, no?
Well, all I can tell you is I know what Supreme Court precedent is. U.S. Supreme Court precedent indicates that that is not a critical stage of the criminal proceedings. I think you also have to understand I am a civil lawyer. I am not a criminal lawyer. But, you know, that being said, and as I started out by saying, we're not opposed to making changes to the system as long as it's done lawfully. And we, as I said before, mm-hmm. we don't think that this is being done lawfully. It's really for others to debate whether it's a good policy decision to have, you know, counsel at arraignment. Our U.S. Supreme Court has said that that's not a critical stage. So right now it is, other than what is in the MIDC Act or in the standards, there is no U.S. Supreme Court case, or for that matter, Michigan Supreme Court case, that says it's constitutionally necessary to have counsel at the arraignment.
Keith Lorimanow is the Corporation Counsel for Oakland County. We want to thank you for your time and for being with us on Stateside, Keith.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Epiphanies.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
For centuries, people who needed fast cash have turned to pawn shops, pawning some personal treasure for a cash loan. There were pawn shops in China some 3,000 years ago, and they're still going strong today, including on our TV screens. Hardcore Pawn spent nine seasons showing us what happened at a Detroit family-run pawn shop. Now there's a modern, new way to pawn an item. Instead of driving around from shop to shop, you can turn to a Michigan-based startup called Pawn Guru and do your dealing online. Jordan Bernholtz is with us now. He's a co-founder of this Southfield-based company. Welcome.
Hi there.
Good to have you here. How did you and your co-founders come up with this idea of doing all of this pawn shop buying and selling online?
We knew we wanted to build an app that would help low-income Americans and people who are underbanked. And we went looking for opportunities in that space. And what we did is go from pawn shop in Detroit, seven or eight of them just driving up and down the city. And we had a backpack full of items. And we wanted to see, you know, how much money would each pawn shop offer us
for each item. Okay. What'd you find?
Well, we found that on average, the amount a pawn shop would offer us for the exact same item would vary by about 400%.
Okay. That's pretty significant.
Yeah. We had a diamond ring that, you know, got $65 at one shop and $1,000 at another.
Why are the discrepancies so big, do you think?
Well, you know, pawn shops have different specialties. They have different amounts of capital on hand. Perhaps one of the pawn shop owners woke up on the wrong side of the bed this morning. But, you know, when you're low income, when you're strapped for cash, you don't have time to go from shop to shop like we did, and you don't feel empowered to negotiate. So we built a website where people can submit their items online, you know, that they want to pawn or sell, or even if they want to buy something. And we let them get offers from multiple local pawn shops so they can choose the one that's best for them.
That is great, especially with transportation being such a challenge for people, as you say, trucking all around, trying to find them and go back and forth. So let's say I want to sell a guitar I no longer need. I'd rather have the cash than having the thing sitting on a shelf. How do I work with Pawn Guru to do that?
So you'd go to our website. You'd put in that you wanted to sell a guitar. You'd take a picture of it, and you'd post it, and you'd wait for dozens of local pawn shops to write back to you with how much they'd pay for it. Musical instruments are an example of a kind of item where the offer spread is pretty significant. So some pawn shops are really skilled at appraising guitars and, you know, other musical instruments, whereas others aren't. And the ones that are going to be a little bit more skilled are going to be able to offer you more money in general.
So you're a clearinghouse.
Yeah, we're a clearinghouse. In a lot of circumstances, people are using Pawn Guru, you know, not because, you know, they're especially strapped for cash. You know, so that's probably half of our users fall into the traditional underbanked pawn demographic, but the other half are just looking for a convenient local alternative to eBay.
Or Craigslist.
The advantage of going to a pawn shop, you don't have to package your item, you don't have to ship it, you don't have to wait 7 days for the money to hit your account. You take it there, done. And, you know, you're going to a professional, clean storefront. And unlike Craigslist, you're not meeting someone in a parking lot and hoping they bring cash.
Why'd you choose Southeast Michigan to launch Pawn Guru?
You know, we're all from here originally. This is where our families are, where our ties are. There's also a fantastic startup community that's grown up in Ann Arbor and in Detroit that we feel really lucky to be a part of.
Now, does it cost anything if I'm a seller for me to list my item?
Not at all.
So do the pawn shops pay you to be able to participate?
Yeah. So we've started, you know, charging pawn shops on a limited basis. It was important to us that, you know, so it's always going to be free for consumers. But in order to show pawn shops, which is sort of a traditional industry, the value of the internet, we had to keep prices low for a while. And we still do.
Well, I can see lots to love for a seller. Do pawn shops like Pawn Guru?
They do. You know, a couple of years ago when we started pitching this, it was a little bit of a conceptual stretch. But now we have, I think, over 1 in 4 pawn shops in the country, so a little over 3,000 pawn shops signed up to our website. And they love it because it brings in traffic they otherwise don't know how to get. 80% of... Gosh, there's a ComScore study that says 80% of consumers look online before making any kind of retail decision. And until now, there was no place for all those people looking online with items they wanted to pawn or sell to go to.
And you say across the country? So you've
That's
got
right.
pawn shops all over.
Yep.
And I assume your long-range plan is keep growing and keep adding pawn shops.
That's right. So long-term, we, like I said, have sort of two customer bases, your traditional underbanked consumer and then, you know, just your regular person trying to sell an item, you know, really quick and get a fair price on it. And we're going to keep expanding into consignment shops and, you know, other sort of used goods stores for those folks. And then for people who are underbanked, we're going to keep looking for ways we can improve financial transparency and offer them, you know, savings products that don't take high fees.
So protecting the consumer in a big way.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty safe, Jordan, to say the pawn industry has a less than stellar reputation. I'm wondering what reactions have you gotten from potential investors when they learned that you were a startup kind of looking to kind of disrupt the pawn shop business and become a part of that conversation?
You know, I think investors can be a little bit wary at first. We're really lucky that we've gotten a lot of support from the Metro Detroit venture community, like Invest Detroit, which saw potential in us really, really early on. So we're really grateful for that. And I think that obviously pawn shops aren't a place people dream about going to in the morning, and we recognize that. But in a lot of ways, the industry has cleaned up its act in the past 30 years, and they're professional, clean, reasonably friendly places to go. And we think it certainly beats meeting a stranger in a parking lot.
And speaking of negative perceptions, I think for some pawn shops are thought of as a place that, to buy or sell stolen goods. First, is that even a legitimate view?
So actually, every time you sell an item to a pawn shop, you're getting fingerprinted. They're taking your name. So the proportion of stolen goods at a pawn shop is much, much lower than it would be on Craigslist or eBay. If you don't mind my saying, you know, mm-hmm. I think that to go back to your question about pawn shops having a negative reputation, mm-hmm. like I said, ideal world, we don't need pawn shops. But they're a much better alternative to payday loans for somebody who's really cash strapped. Payday loans, if you don't succeed in paying one back quickly, you're locked in a cycle of debt. And obviously, we don't want someone to lose, you know, a possession that has some meaning or value to them. But it's a lot better than being locked into debt for years and years and years.
Jordan Bernholtz is co-founder of the Southfield-based company Pawn Guru. And we want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, what's it like to be Black and Muslim in Michigan in 2017?
The popular narrative is to demonize and otherize Islam from being American.
After the break, our conversation with two members of that community. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our mission here on Stateside is to explore and listen to the many different voices in our state, views on race, religion, economics, opportunity, or lack of it. The point of view we're bringing you now is that of African-American Muslims. With us now is Dr. Haleem Naeem, a psychologist who's based in Livonia, and Tahira Khalid, who's a head counselor at Muslim Family Services in Detroit. Welcome to both of you. It is so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Honored to be here.
I'm going to start really right out of the gate. I'm going to toss this one at you. And Tahira, I'm going to start with you. What does it mean to be Black and Muslim in America at this moment in our history?
A realization that all identity now carries a power. And it depends on how well-versed people are in terms of knowledge about alternative communities as to how they react. It depends on how I walk through the world, and I attempt by being a Muslim to walk in peace and be prepared for opposite reactions. But I've been blessed not to have a great deal of negativity come at me. I've been really surprised in the political atmosphere that we live in now. The people have really worked very diligently to find out what it does mean to be a Muslim.
When you say the people, who?
Neighbors, basic people in stores.
People who are not Muslim, who want to know more?
Are really hungry about what this means. I've been really touched in my heart by how much effort people are working to narrow the divide. I just was driving through in Ann Arbor because we had extra time, and I saw, I guess it was a fraternity house, say that we love and respect Muslims and immigrants. That was a sign.
Wow.
And it was just heartening to see that. If people have a problem with me being African-American and Muslim, people basically, unless they're on some kind of fringe, have enough political consciousness not to come right out. But that can be a blessing as well as a problem.
Haleem, what's been your experience?
Well, it's a lot of things, being Black and Muslim. Number one, there's, you know, we're talking about history and a context of how we come into society, of how we're positioned in society. Mm-hmm. And it means a couple of layers of marginalization, discrimination, mm-hmm. and at many times in popular media, we're demonized mm-hmm. at a number of different levels. Mm-hmm. You know, every night you see mm-hmm. on Channel 7 news and different mm-hmm. things like that, the faces of people who actually commit certain crimes. And then, you know, on top of that, you have Muslims mm-hmm. and you have Black Muslims mm-hmm. and you have this push that we see of Islam to be something exotic, mm-hmm. to be something not American, mm-hmm. to be not part of our culture. Islam is as American as baseball, as apple pie, as a number of different things.
With deep historic roots.
With very deep historic roots. And a lot of things, we look at history of how our government runs and different things like that, it's been taken from a lot of patterns have been taken from Islamic traditions. So with me, I have a few hats that are worn that are marginalized, that I would say just the name being Muslim, you know, people don't think about when you're applying to jobs, when you're applying and, you know, doing certain things, how that'll demonize you applying to schools and different things like that when people see you and everything.
I'm very interested in if you've sensed a change since President Trump's election in the months since. And Tahira, as you describe people kind of going out of their way, or the sign that you saw today coming into Ann Arbor, do you think there are people that are kind of trying to go the extra mile to maybe offset some of the narrative?
I think people are very curious. I think people now are struggling to find out where they stand. I see with myself, and I know Halim, Dr. Halim, people I've even seen in meetings. I sit on several boards. I'm very involved in the academic world, clinical world. I live in a lot of worlds that I find people are constantly trying to figure me out. Who is she and how does her Islam and heritage impact my relationship with her? And I can't say it's always positive. It's a huge curiosity. I'm very upset with the media, as Halima said, and the way the narrative is played out. The images are very powerful. Images teach.
What images that you see that
I see the images that I don't see. I don't see the image of the African-American Muslim mm-hmm. woman mm-hmm. presented at all. Mm-hmm. If they interview someone, it is an Arab hijabi woman, and that's my sister. But there are a lot of differences in this religion, culturally, politically. So even within us, we're not a monolith. We're a vast array of people, a huge number. I think I saw a statistic, the large majority of babies that will be born in this country by 2035 will be Muslim babies. Mm. There's a huge population that now exists in our country, but each set of individuals have a different understanding, education. I see America grappling with what that means for their own well-being, but the media images are not positive. And media is one that I've talked to media people. Well, we go for the controversy. Go for the controversy, but show some of the positive images. We have a clinic that was set up by the Muslim Center of Detroit called the Huda Clinic. It's a federally protected clinic that serves the poor and underserved populations in the city. We had a huge fundraiser about a couple months ago. The medical school sends staff. We have pharmacy, dermatology, ophthalmology, everyone is in that clinic. So we have a huge fundraiser to help support the money that the federal grant doesn't cover. We had a cross-section of cultures, religions, Americans. We had European Americans. We actually saw a news truck pull up because they saw this huge number of people coming to the Muslim Center, stop and pull away. That would have been an excellent story to show that we are working to take care of the medically underserved in this country. And we're working as European Americans, Black Americans, we're professionals.
And that story didn't get told.
The head of the health department at the time was Dr. Abdul Al Said spoke. He's Arab, a brother that's now running for governor. Mm-hmm. It would have been an excellent narrative to change the pejorative view of us being a drain on the society and not being of great benefit.
But that's the thing. The popular narrative, and there's a lot of benefit that comes out from it. There's a lot of money in terrorizing people and fear-mongering and things like that. So, I mean, you know, you don't have to search far for it. But the popular narrative is to demonize and otherize Islam from being American.
That goes back in American history. Somebody was always the other.
Yes. Exactly.
Somebody was always
exactly.
the other.
And why?
It's our turn now. You know, we have an interest as Black people mm-hmm. and as Muslim people. We have an interest in the sustainability mm-hmm. of the integrity of this country. And we Black people see ourselves as being the economic foundation of the country mm-hmm. because we are. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of people built their empires of wealth and everything like that. You don't have to go that far into history books. So we've always been gung-ho. We've always been on the team of, all right, let's try and make this a better place for everyone. Now, you know, again, people get their turns. The Chinese got their turn in the 40s. And, you know, well, Black people have been having their turn since mm-hmm.
the beginning.
You know, even 100 years ago, Jews and Irish people or whatever. but for us to use these tactics towards whole communities and other groups of people so that a select few can have this type of life and sustain themselves, that's not going to last. That's not going to be a sustainable method for our country.
We're talking about what it means to be Black and Muslim in Michigan as we talk with Tahira Khalid, who's head counselor at Muslim Family Services in Detroit, and Dr. Halim Naeem, who's a psychologist based in Livonia. Halim, how is the Muslim religion generally perceived by the larger African-American community?
It's mixed view. And there's a historical context to that. But I think a lot of media has started to slant it, quite frankly, a little more towards a negative direction. There used to be a lot of respect. Like when I was younger, I'm 35 years old. And I remember when I was single digits, in the 80s and in the 90s, there was a tremendous amount of respect for Islam within the Black community.
What's changed?
A number of things. One, the overall position towards Islam, I think, to really demonize it at a whole nother level has changed. And then two, I think that the growth of Muslims and people seeing more Muslims rather than Islam, people coming up short on what their ideals and what their principles are supposed to be. So now,
people who don't represent true
essentially,
Islam.
Yes. People don't necessarily represent Islam mm-hmm. as it's actually intended mm-hmm. because over time, like mm-hmm. Sister Tahira is saying, there's more people, mm-hmm. more babies, more growth. Mm-hmm. And again, I would attribute a lot of this. Okay, this is not just an African-American issue. This is also, you have to look at this in the context of institutionalized racism mm-hmm. and the breakup of families mm-hmm. and the astronomical distribution and financial oppression, mm-hmm. just poverty. Mm-hmm. So when you have other things that affect people, when you have these things that affect households and you take certain habits and take certain survival tactics and ways to cope, then you're not going to necessarily always represent, you know, the best ideals.
Tahira, I'm interested in what you've seen through your life, the relationship between people in Black Muslim American communities and immigrant or non-Black American Muslims.
I had the privilege of being raised Muslim. My father accepted Islam in the early 50s. He rejected Christianity because he felt that that was a tool to keep us oppressed, that if we had been enslaved as a people. This is one of the most egregious enslavements. Slavery has always existed in the world. But the narrative of a Western and particularly American is now being documented by many historians, many of whom are European. But as we look and read the histories, the egregious enslavement of our people, which was called chattel slavery, we've actually been put in the status with animals, which mm-hmm. would justify the inhumanity which we've endured. We were sold away. There were even rules in slavery around the world. Baby would not be sold from its mother. We were enslaved. We were raped. I was looking at some Sinhalese brothers who came to the masjid uh-huh. recently. Uh-huh. They are the color of this uh-huh. headphone. They are black that you realize if that's where we started and where this we have truly been mixed within the various cultures biologically in terms of heredity. So my father rejected if a group of people could rape my mother, sell my children on the slave block. But if they come to me with a Bible, a religious document, why would I accept it? Huh. It has to be part of a narrative of marginalization. It has to be a trick. My father rejected Christianity as part of a tool of oppression.
So you have
spent
your
whole life in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've
seen,
yeah. I've seen a greater respect as Islam has grown. Mm-hmm. What I am aware of is the programming of non-Black people that starts in the Middle East. So when they come here, mm-hmm. they're anti-African-American because they've been trained to be anti-African-American when they get here. And I've had to tell some of the immigrants, you're here because of the civil rights movement that my family made. Mm. My family, my ancestors were beaten and raped, but still put together voting's right. We marched, and that door opened up the opportunity for all of you to come here. So for you not to give me salams, because you were told that if I'm African-American, that I'm less than a person, that's on you. See, one thing about the world.
Do they hear you when you say that?
Yeah,
they
have to think about that.
Do you see the walls coming down?
Yes, we presented that. Dr. Halim had me present a conference, and people sort of blew back. It becomes very difficult sometimes for us to continually wear that badge, but I'm not that person. I will tell the truth. So many times we apologize. A lot of the enslavement and the chattel enslavement, which allowed us to be three-fifths of people, even in the Constitution, has us so diminished. We're ashamed. So we're constantly finding a way to keep the discussion from happening because we don't want to be heard anymore. I'm not afraid of that. Let us put the truth on the table so we can redo it. So the truth is there's a lot of division, divisiveness that's programmed and planted among communities, once again for the benefit of a few people who are at the top and who use that to keep us at odds with each other so they can control us all.
Yeah, anti-blackness is not just a phenomenon that's in America. This is something that has grown, that's been the case. The issue is, and I mean, it's a history thing because we got to be real, and you're talking about colonization that already had anti-black sentiments coming into Arabized communities and chopping up the Middle East. That's why it's called the Middle East and all this other stuff 300-500 years ago, and chopping that stuff up and getting in there and educating and teaching people certain things.
Passing
what's right.
Along the attitudes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. What's right and what's wrong. And now you come here and now people who look like me are supposed to simply be scrubbing toilets and whatever. That comes across in a number of different ways when there's this, superiority complex. And then you have African-American people, because of the trauma and internalized racism, they've transferred that. They've transferred that from, you know, from trying to be like master, from trying to be like European-American, to trying to ascend religiously as an immigrant.
All right. I have to ask about something that I'm sure, especially you, Tahira, growing up through your life as Muslim, how do you address people, and let's be honest, white people, who think that black Muslims just hate white folks, and they get stopped right there.
So I was working on a project at the DMC, and one of the nurses walked up and said, we had a very good relationship, and then she came up to me and she said, oh, I didn't know you're Muslim. Okay, you didn't. And so she said, well, my uncle said you all hate white people. I said, you know what, I'm not going to go on that narrative with you. I just want to ask you, how have I treated you? How have I treated you? I said, now you were learning your catechisms about a month ago, and you want to repeat them to someone to make sure that you got to the next level in your religion. Nobody would listen to those verses but me. She stopped. She said, I have to think about that. I said, you know, we have people in the world, your uncle, I don't know where that came from. I don't know what he understands. The only thing I can go on now is my relationship with you. Have I done anything to diminish you or mistreat you? She came back the next day and she hugged me, said I was wrong. But I'm glad you put it on the table. There are some people, I had a secretary whose husband came in and saw me. She turned totally different. And I asked her, I said, what happened with us? And she said, well, my husband said you hate white people. I said, once again, what have I done? But it wasn't enough for her because her relationship with him. And what is his knowledge base? I haven't grown up as a Muslim, though. I've seen the respect of Islam grow, especially in the African-American community. See, this is a very divided society. We as African-Americans have to interact with everyone. I interact with Europeans, Arabs. European-Americans many times don't see anyone except the ones in their own little communities. And they've told me, well, if all the rest of black people are like you. I've had a professor up at U of M, one of my clinical professors, saying, Tahira, if everybody else was like you. I said, well, first of all, how many black people do you know? And I'm no different than you. Can't insult my people and honor me. Most African Americans are doing the same thing. And we have the sideline, the sidewinders. We have the little people on the side, not well, trying to raise their families, feed their families, educate their families. That's what most people are doing. You don't know any black people. And so you judge, and I'm not necessarily an example, but you've taken the media narrative. I don't hear those conversations, people who are enlightened who've gone out to seek. So basically, just a lack of knowledge.
Tahira Khalid is head counselor at Muslim Family Services in Detroit, and Dr. Halim Naeem is a psychologist who's based in Livonia. Thank you so much to both of you for being
with us.
Thank you
for the honor to be here. What a blessing. You're part of the new change.
That's great.
a quick note before we go. Today's show featured some interviews that we have aired earlier this year on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.